All right, we're beginning here on the top of Chav Hei. I'm on the Aleph by the two dots. Here we have a story. Sabe de Nizunya, lo ato de pirke de Rav Chista. The elders of Nizunya did not come to the drosha of Rav Chista. Generally, the pirke was involved before the chagim, when the Rosh Yeshiva or the leader would give over the halachot of the holiday. And generally, all the people from the surrounding areas would attend the drosha. Could be referring to that, or sometimes Pirkei is used to refer to the drasha on Shabbat. Whatever it is, that they felt that they didn't want to come to the drasha of Rav Chista. Amar lei Rav Amnuna, so he tells Rav Amnuna, zil tzaninhu. So go ahead and, Rashi over here says that tzaninhu is lihizager. Close them in. Lesheva bayit, and keep them in their house, which is a lashon of nidui. Put them into nidui because they're acting inappropriately. They're not paying proper respect to the Rosh Yeshiva, or to the leader of the major yeshiva in that area. Azala marluhu, my taima loatu rabbonon lepirka. So he went and spoke to these Talmidei Chachamim and said, why aren't you coming to the drasha of Rav Chista? Amrulei, amai neite, why are we going to come? Debeinen mine milta, velo pashalon. We ask him questions, and he doesn't know the answer. So here you have their claim that they don't go to the drosha because they find Rav Chista not sufficiently erudite to answer the questions that they pose to him or the issues that they raise with him. So now Rav Amnuna does something interesting. He says, "Amar lahu, mi beitu minai midei velo pashitna luchu? Did you ever ask me about anything and I didn't give you an answer?" Which is an interesting question from Rav Nuna's standpoint, because Rav Chista didn't send Rav Amnuna to do that. He sent them to put them into nidui. And Rav Amnuna over here says, well, why don't you ask me? I'll try to answer the questions. That partly has to do with the fact that Rav Amnuna is a chover of Rav Chista, not necessarily a talmid of Rav Chista. There are actually two Rav Amnunas that live in very close proximity. One of them is a talmid of Rav Chista. Rav Amnuna that we're speaking about here seems likely not to be the talmid of Rav Chista, but rather his peer, or his chover. And so Rav Amnuna had a standing of his own. And therefore Rav Amnuna says, yeah, okay, maybe Rav Chista doesn't know, but you could ask me as well. And Rav Amnuna is known throughout Shas as what's called Bei Rav, of the Beit Midrash of Rav. He was a Talmid of Rav. And he perpetuates the Torah of Rav. And being Bei Rav, we know that Rav Huna and Rav Chista also are Talmidim of Rav. So by Minei, so then they did ask a question of him. Eved shesir sora bo bebitzim mahu. So an eved which the owner causes him to become impotent through his testicles, what is the din? Kim mum shibigalui dami. It has the same status as being a visible mum, because they are discernible or visible from the outside, meaning that you have the testicles that sit within the sack. So technically you can't see what's going on inside because they're not directly visible. Yet certain things, if you can discern what has happened, even though you can't directly see them. So that's what the Gemara asks. Is it kemum shegabalui dami? Because you can see what is going on with the testicles inside. If they're there, if they're not there, if they're crushed, if they're not crushed, you have some sense of what's happening. Although, or maybe not. Meaning that since they're not directly visible, that's not considered to be a mum shebigalui. Remember, when it came to an eved, yesterday we established that Shein V'ayin had three qualifications. One is it's a mum shebigalui, it's a visible mum. Number two is that it's mevatol oto melachto, that it ruins the function of that limb. And number three was it's enu chuzer lebriato. It's something that does not cure or rehabilitate in any way. So over here, we have at least two of these items, which is for sure, it is a davar she'enu chuzer lebriato. It's not something that's going to regrow, something that's going to go back to the status it was before. Number two is, it's definitely mevatel oto melachto. It can no longer function the way it did before. Our only question is about the galui aspect of this. How galui is galui? Does galui mean you really have to be able to see it with your own eyes? Or is it the fact that you can discern it? Is that enough to be considered mum shebigalui? Lo hava biyodei. He didn't know the answer to the question. So already he's in a bad position. He challenged them to ask him a question. Now they ask him a question, he doesn't have the answer. Amrulo mashmecho. They said to him, what's your name? Amar Lahu says to them, Hamnuna. So Amrei Lei, love Hamnuna, Ella Karnuna. Says, you're not Hamnuna, but rather a Karnuna. The way Rashi translates now over Karnuna is, Yoshev Kranot Ata, Velo Bal Torah. You are Yoshev Kranot, that's what you say when you do a Simon Mesechta, that Hashem should make us Miyoshve Beit HaMidrash, Velo Miyoshve Kranot. Yoshev Kranot to the people that sit outside the cafes and schmooze and drink all day, but not productive in any way. So they're saying, oh, you're not really Hamnuna, Elo Karnuna. Now, the way Rashi explains it, that's a pretty serious slight to Rabbi Hamnuna, the fact that they're calling him no longer Hamnuna, but rather Karnuna. Some point out that the word Hamnuna comes from the word Hemnuta. The loose translation when we use it in the Gemara is Emuna. But Emuna comes from somebody who is steadfast and always there, or reliable. Naaman is used in the sense of reliable. So he says, you're not Hamnuna reliably in the Beit Midrash, or Karnuna, the guy who's hanging out in the street corners. Still a pretty big slight. You can see in Tosafot he brings an alternative shot from the Beinu Hananel, which is Hamnuna is a contraction of Cham and Nuna. Nuna in Aramaic is a fish. Cham would be hot fish. They said to him, you're not Hamnuna, but rather Karnuna. You're a cold fish. So now, whether that has to do with, if they're speaking about him in particular and saying, you know, you're no hot fish, you're a cold fish, or they're speaking about what he's saying to them, or what he's speaking to them, you're telling us things that have no basis. You're telling us to ask you questions, and you have no ability to answer the question. And so that's what they're saying, Hamnuna, Karnuna, they're speaking about what he said to them, rather about him in particular. In that case, it's a slightly less of a slight than that which Rashi suggested. Ata the kamei de Rav Chista, so Rav Hamnuna comes back to Rav Chista, Amar lei matnitu by minach, says that it's a brayta that is explicit. So that's interesting. Rav Chista here does not criticize Rav Hamnuna, but in the end, Rav Hamnuna tried to put himself out as being the one able to answer the questions, even though Rav Chista can't. And ironically, in the end, right, Rav Hamnuna couldn't answer the question. Rav Chista knew the answer to the question. So I don't know if that's a veiled criticism of Rav Hamnuna in terms of the Midah Keneged Midah. He tried to present himself as being on par or even better than Rav Chista. And in the end, turns out that he didn't know the answer, and Rav Chista did know the answer, which is the Tnan. The truth is, this is a Mishnah, but it's also a Tosefta. And similarly, the Gemara is quoting the Tosefta because of the additional information that's brought over here about the other Shitot that do not appear in the Mishnah, that do appear in the Tosefta. So it is written Tnan, which is correct, but it's more likely that we're quoting the Tanya, the Braita from the Tosefta. There are 24 primary limbs that are in a person. Kulam ein mitami mishum michya. None of them are tamei mishum michya. Tis parshat haShavua. This is about nigaim, tzarat. When it comes to tzarat, the requirement of the size of a nega tzarat is to be a grease. The size of a pool, size of a bean. And it has to be lemar'ei enei haKohen. It's to be visible to the Kohen in one shot, that size. These roshei avarim, which are these primary limbs, but it means limbs that come to a point. Those locations of the point, the nega, if it moves across that area, would not be visible in one glance at that area. The person would have to turn, for instance, for the coin to see both sides of it. So if you took either the tip of your finger, the tip of your nose, in those cases, if you had a nega tzarat that spread across both sides of the finger, or both sides of the nose, the Kohen's looking at you with one glance, or Mar'ei Enei HaKohen, he can't see the whole nega. He'd have to have you turn your face a little bit this way, turn that way, move your finger this way, move that way. That's not considered to be a nega tzarat because of that. The example brought here by the Mishnah is the case of Michya, which is a special case within Nigaim. That is that if you have a nega that spreads across the entirety of the body, what's called Parach Bikulo, then that is a siman tahara. That's one way you can become tor, counterintuitively. If you have a nega tzarat, you're tamei. But if it spreads to the entirety of the body, where the entire body of the individual is covered in a nega, then you're also tahor. That person will become tamei biyom that they have a michya. Michya means live and healthy skin that is found there. So any, if you have a michya, that would ruin or undermine parach bikulo, if the nega spread across the entire body. What the Gemara is saying here is if you have a mechiyah and a rosh ever, if you have a mechiyah at the tip of one of these evarim, that would not be a disqualifying factor, because again, the mechiyah cannot be seen in one shot unless you move that limb around or you move your face for it able to be visible. And so therefore that mechiyah would not disqualify the parach bikulo, and you would still remain tahor. Ve'elohim. And these are the 24. Roshei etzbaot, yadayim v'raglayim, five fingers, five toes, you're up to 20. Roshei oznayim, tips of the ears. Rosh achotem, so with the oznayim, you're up to 22. Rosh achotem, the nose, is 23. V'rosha gvi'a. And then the tip of the member, which would be 24. And now they add on, v'rosh dadim should be isha. And for a woman, the tip of her breast would also have that same impact. Rabbi Yehuda Meir, af shebi'ish. Rabbi Yehuda says that even in a man, that same thing applies to his chest. Obviously, the difference with the Tanna Kamma is that the woman's chest is more shaped, so that makes more sense that you can't see it on both sides. Whereas for a man, it's less likely to be that way. V'tani Allah, and this is what I said, that the Braita, that we have the qualifying statement on that, b'kulam eved yotzei behem lecherut. Then in all those cases, these are the same Roshei Evarim by which an Eved goes out free. Now, you can notice in that list of 24, there are two major limbs that are missing for an Eved, which is Shein V'ayin. Shein V'ayin are the things that are mentioned in the Torah for an Eved Kenani, yet they're absent from the list. And as Rashi notes over here, is V'Shein V'ayin lo itzrich le the Rebbe limnot v'tosefta t'behejuktiv v'zil kari be'ravu. Those are explicit in the Torah. And you tell them, weren't you in Cheder? Didn't you learn Chumash? You know that Shein V'Ayin are included in the list. So even though Shein V'Ayin are the primary and the paradigmatic Evarim that are mentioned in the Torah, it's not listed in the Tosefta because it's so obvious. The Tosefta lists the other 24 that also give the Eved this freedom. Now here, in terms of paralleling the issues, it's not an exact parallel. It's not saying that any time for a nega, it's not good. Then for an eved ivri, that's considered Rosh Evarim. It's giving you broad swaths. In this instance, these 24 Evarim, for totally different reasons, by the case of the Tarat, they would not be a disqualifying factor or make you tamei. And for the eved ivri, they would release you. Rabbi Omer af hasirus. Rabbi says also castration would have that same impact. Benazai Omer, afalashon. Benazai adds the tongue in as well as being an Aver, a Rosh Aver, by which an Eved would go free. Again, because he thinks, and you can understand what the issue is, tongue is obviously an essential Aver, and if it's cut out, it's Batel Mimelachto, and Enu Chuzer Lebriato. It ruins its function when it's cut out. It does not regenerate or rehabilitate in any way. The only question is about Gilui, again over here, which is that considered to be visible or not visible? Because when your mouth is closed, you don't see the tongue. But when you speak or when you eat, you do see the tongue possibly. So is that galui or not galui? And then Benazai claims that the Lashon is bigalui. Because the question is, then how different is that than a Shein? Right? So it might be that teeth are more naturally visible than the tongue. Because the person, just when they open their mouth or they smile, their teeth are visible, their tongue is not visible. Tongue's only visible when they open their mouth, or sometimes when they're speaking or eating, it's more visible, but the teeth are more visible than the tongue. Although that might be his association. He might say, just like the teeth, they're considered to be visible, so too the tongue should be considered visible. Rabbi is clearly addressing the issue that we want, which is sirus. Does sirus have an impact? Is that considered to be galoy? The same question that we raised before with Rav Hamnuna. Here's your answer. It's a machloket between Rabbi and the Tanna Kamma as to whether Sirus is considered to be Galoi or not Galoi. And that would be the answer to their question. So now Amamar, now the Gemara discusses this. Rabbi Omer Afa Sirus. Sirus Demai. What is the castration that was done here that he's considered to be Galoi, but that the fact that the Tanna Kamma disagrees with it? Can't be too obvious, because then why does the Tanna Kamma disagree? Can't be completely not visible, because then why does Rabbi say it? So that's what the Gemara is trying to discover. Ilem es sirus de gid. If you're talking about the castration, the cutting off of the member, hainu gvia. That's mentioned by the Tanna Kamma already, which is rosh gvia, right? The tip of the member. Elalav sirus de beitzim. It must be that Rabbi is speaking about castration through the dislocation, the crushing, the ruining of the testicles. So therefore, the answer to your question is that's exactly what the machloket is about over here between Rabbi and the Tanakhama, is about Sirus Beitzim, which was the question posed by the Sabei de Nizunia. That's what Rav Chisda is saying. The answer to their question is found in this braita. Rabbi Omer, Af HaSirus. So now, Rabbi, when he says over here, also the Sirus, V'Rabbi Lashon Lo, says Rabbi thinks the tongue is not considered to be Galoi. So if you think about, in context, Rabbi who says that the testicles are considered to be Galoi, even though they're completely concealed, wouldn't he believe that the tongue, which is partially concealed, at least visible when the mouth is open, that certainly should be revealed? So how come Rabbi does not also include the Lashon? V'Raminu, Harimisha Ya Mazeh, V'Nitzeh HaZa'ah Alpiv. Person who they are sprinkling on for the Tahara of the Parah Aduma, and the sprinkling goes on to his mouth. Rabbi Omer Hizah. Rabbi says he's satisfied the obligation for sprinkling or becoming tohor. Chamim omrim lo hizah. It's not considered to be sprinkling because it never landed on the individual, never went on the individual. Obviously, over here, the hazaah that is being done only goes on the mouth, not somewhere else. So here you have hazaah by the paraduma, you have it by the mitzorah as well. There's a din of hazaah. My love, what does it mean that it went into its mouth and nowhere else? Alishono. It seems to be it's going on his tongue. And we're assuming here that the hazaah has to go on to the parts of the body that are open, revealed, things that are visible. And since over here it went to his mouth and Rabbi's saying it's good, he must believe whatever it is visible. What is he speaking about? Must be speaking about the tongue. And that means that Rabbi believes the tongue is a visible aver. Where it says, lo, al-svatav. It's sprinkled on his lips. Al-svatav, pshita. If it's sprinkled on his lips, then why doesn't everybody agree that that's considered to be bigalui? Because your lips are always visible. Marutema, zimlin dechalim svatei. Because sometimes a person presses his lips together, and therefore they no longer are visible. So sometimes they are visible, sometimes they are not visible. Because as Rashi says, the word chalim over here means davarshu madbik yafeh, something that is connected well, stuck together well. And then he gives the French, the old French for that is soldor, or soldering, which is spelt in that way. It's a French word that was carried over into the English language where the L is not pronounced anymore. But he's talking about soldering, which is a strong connection, especially with metallic objects. So that's what he says the chalim is over here. The chalim svatei is that he can press his lips together. He can stick them together. So you would have thought that's not considered to be a makom galoi. Kamash Malon, the rabbi says that it is a makom galoi. The chachamim disagree and said that it's not considered to be a makom galoi. And therefore the hazaah doesn't work in that case. Vatanya. So now don't we have a braita? Alishono. That explicitly says that the sprinkling went onto his tongue. Vatanya. And we have another braita that says, Vishnital Rov Halashon, that the mumim that are described of a bechor, one of them is Rov Halashon. The majority of the tongue was cut out. Rabbi Omer, Rov HaMidaber Shiblishono. When we talk about the removal of the tongue, we're not talking about a rov of the complete tongue, but rather the part of the tongue, I'll call it the wagging part of the tongue, the part of the tongue that's used to speak with. The tongue is attached inside of your mouth. There's a section of the tongue that goes from the point that's attached that is loosed, and that's the wagging part of the tongue, the part that is used to swallow, the parts that are used to speak with. So he says that the rove that you're mentioning over here is not the rove of the entire tongue. It's a rove of the tongue that is the speaking part of the tongue, or the flexible part of the tongue, the part that is detached and not attached within the mouth. And so from that you see, Rabbi believes that the Lashon is an area of a mum shibi galui. He sees it both in the case of tahara and hazaah. We try to explain it with lips, but if you explain it with tongue, and if you assume that that's the case, then Rabbi believes the tongue is a makom shibi galui. We just said by the bechor, the makom that is considered to be a mum on the tongue, he says is the midaber part of the tongue, which is clearly because he wants the visible part of the tongue. and he sees that as being a visible Eifer. If that's the case, why is it that Rabbi in our Mishnah does not mention Lashon or tongue as well? Ela Rabbi Omer, Sirus, Velo Mibai Lashon. This is what we expressed somewhat before, which is when Rabbi says that Sirus, castration or affecting the testicles, is considered to be a Mum Shibigaloi, then certainly the tongue is considered to be a Mum Shibigaloi. Again, if the testicles are kept within the scrotum, and it's completely not visible, it's an intuitive visibility, then certainly the tongue, which is visible when the mouth is open, it can be seen here and there, so that should be considered to be galut. I mean, you could argue against that and say that with regards to the scrotum, the testicles are always visible once you notice it. If there's a problem, you can see it all the time, even though it's not directly visible. By the tongue, sometimes it's visible, sometimes it's not visible. But anyway, the Gemara sees this as being a lomi bai. If you can assume that the testicles are visible, even though they're not, then certainly the tongue, which at times is visible, will be that way as well. That means Rabbi believes that Sirus and Lashon are. Ben Azai Omer, Lashon aval Sirus lo. So Ben Azai, when he comes to argue on Rabbi Akiva, says, Lashon yes, but Sirus no. He's agreeing with Rabbi on one point, but disagreeing on the other point. He's saying, I agree with you on the tongue point, but I disagree with regards to the testicles. So then, umay af. Problem with that is the way that Ben Azai's position is expressed. Ben Azai says, af halashon, also the tongue. And when you say also, that means that whatever someone said before is included, and now you're additive, you're adding something on. If, where Ben Azai is found in the Mishnah, he's the last opinion in the Mishnah, and he comes after Rabbi Akiva. Which means that when he says, af halashon, it makes it sound like, yeah, Rabbi Akiva, you're right about Sirus, but I add tongue. I see you, and I raise you. I see you on the Sirus, and then I raise you and say, af lashon, which would be just the opposite of the way we're explaining the bright at this point. So, Mar says, my af, akamaito. So then, what do you do with the word af? It's going on the Tanakama's position. Iochi. Okay, that's a nice explanation to say when he says af, he means the Tanakama is 24, plus tongue. But, iochi, if that's the case, nekadma de ben azai bereisha. Then the order of the brighta is somewhat circumspect because why is Ben Azai coming after Rabbi when he is additive to the Tanakama? And Rabbi Akiva is additive to Ben Azai. You would have thought that the Mishnah would have written the Tanakama's position. Then Ben Azai who adds on the tongue. And then Rabbi Akiva who says not only tongue, but also Sirus. That should be the proper order. So Gemara says, Tana Shama Dulu Rabbi Vikova. The Tana had heard the position of Rabbi, and therefore he put it right after the Tanakama. The Shama to the Ben Azai. Afterwards, he heard the opinion of Ben Azai, Vitani, and then he added Ben Azai to the Braita. Umishna lozaza mim koma. So you say, once he heard about Ben Azai, why didn't he insert Ben Azai between the Tanakama and Rabbi Akiva where he belongs? Because the original Mishnah doesn't move from its place. Rashi says something very interesting over here. Elamachar shenikva shel Rabbi etzel Tanakama. Once it was already established that Rabbi's position was mentioned next to the Tanakama's, all the Talmidim had it or had memorized it in that way. We do not change the order. The nota. Once you've learned something by heart, it's very hard to change that. To try to learn it some other way. I mean that once you have reviewed and established something in your memory as being Torah Sheba'al Peh, and remember, when they're learning Torah Sheba'al Peh, they're literally learning it by heart. Once you've established something or memorized something in this manner, it's very hard then to afterwards to go to try to change it. So if you keep the original block intact, which is Tanakam and Rabbi, which is the way they learned it originally, and then just add on Ben Azai, that will be easy for them to deal with. If you then change the whole thing and say, oh, here's the Tanakam, here's Ben Azai, then Rabbi, they will get confused and it'll make it hard for them. And therefore, even though from a logical standpoint, it would make sense to say Tanakama, Ben Azai, and Rabbi, but because of the nature in which the Braita was taught, or they heard about the Braita, it was first the Tanakama, then Rabbi, and then only later Ben Azai did they hear about. So when they added on Ben Azai, he was tacked on at the end as an appendix, not as something where he belongs in the logical sequence of the Braita. So Amar Ula, Hakol Modim B'Lashon Le'inyan Tuma D'Galuihu Eitzel Sheretz. That everybody agrees that when it comes to a sheretz, or tumata sheretz, that that's considered to be a location that is galui. So as opposed to over here by the case of a mum, Shebe'ivarim. And possibly by Hazaaf, you explain it that way, where we have a machloket about whether the tongue is considered to be begalui or not. He says when it comes to Tumata Sheretz, everybody agrees that that's considered to be galui. Because we have a principle with regards to Tuma, which is maga beit astarim. If you have contact with a place that is normally covered or not visible, that it does not convey Tuma. My taima, because ashei gabo achmar achmano is something that you can touch or come into contact with. Baha nami bar negiyahu. This is something that you can come into contact with. So now Rashi quotes this. This is a pasuk that is by the Zav and not by Sheretz. But Rashi says over here that the limud is the following. It says, Mechol asher yiga bo azav, that anything the Zav touches is tamei. V'yadav lo shatap b'mayim, and his hands weren't washed in the water. Hashatap b'mayim, if he did wash his hands in the water, then he would be tahor. Doesn't he need tefillah? So the truth is that the Gemara in other places darshins v'yadav lo shatap b'mayim to teach you that he does require tefillah. And the reason that they use v'yadav is to teach you that the tefillah does not need to include beit astarim, which is something that we're going to get to in the Gemara in a second. But the way Rashi is learning it out over here is that the limud connects the haga'ah by the zav to yadav lo shataf mamayim, saying that what type of negiyah do you need is v'yadav lo shataf mamayim. Therefore, we reinterpret chol asher yigo b'zav doesn't mean anything he touches, but anything that is visible, like his hands, which is that anything that is exposed, like the hands, that is the type of negi'ah by the zav that will cause tuma to be conveyed. And so therefore, the yadav lo shatap b'mayim. And so therefore, anything that is similar to yadayim will be able to accept tuma. And therefore, things that are covered or beit astarim will not accept or have tuma conveyed to them. And so Rashi is using the same libo that the Gemara uses in other places to teach you that the tefillah does not require beit astarim to be covered, to teach you that tumah is also not conveyed to beit astarim. That's the way Rashi learns it. On the other hand, there is an alternate girsa, and that the girsa should be asher tiga and not asher yiga, which is from the pasuk in Vayikrahe with the Kurban Olev Yored, which says, O nefesh asher tiga b'chol davar tamei, O benivlat chayat tamei, O benivlat behemat tamei, O benivlat sheretz tamei, v'nela memenu v'tamei Hashem, O ki yiga b'tumat adam. So over there you have negi'ah that is expressed more generically about tumah in general, and not particular to the case of Zav, which is questionable whether you can extrapolate from the dinim of Zav, and therefore they favor Girsa, not like what we have in our Gemara, quoting the Pasuk from Vayikra Tetvav, which is about a Zav, but rather the Pasuk in Vayikra Hei, which is talking about Negiata Tuma in general. So over here, when it comes to the Lashon, the tongue, that is something that you can come into contact with, something that you can make contact with, and therefore it has a din of being a, not a makom beit astarim, but a galui, a place that's galui. If you come into contact with it, it will convey tuma. That's number one. Ulehian tvila kitamun domi. In the terms of going to the mikveh, it's considered to be a makom starim that does not need to enter into the mikveh. My taima. It says, rachatz bisaro b'mayim amar rachmano. It says that you must enter your body, your flesh, into the water. Ma bisaro me evrai, afko me evrai. Just like your flesh is on the outside, so too, only the outside of your body needs to come into contact with the mikveh. So that means that, for instance, areas like one's eyes, one's mouth, inside of one's ears, inside of one's nostrils, do not need to go into the mikveh. They do not need to come into contact with the waters of the mikveh because those are inside and not outside. Lo nechoku elinyan hazaah. The machloket here is only about hazah. Rabbi midame le tumah, Rabbona midame le tfilah. Rabbi connects it to tumah and says, just like by tumah, the lashon is considered to be visible, so too, the taharami tumah, the tongue is a visible location that if the hazah goes on it, it will be mitaher. Rabbona midame le tfilah. When it comes to being mitaher a person, tfilah is the vehicle of tahara. So Tovir Haza'ah, which is a vehicle of Tara, should follow that same precedent, and the tongue will be considered Tamun and not Galoi. They're both arguing about the Pasuk that we just read from Pashat Parah. Bizah HaTohor Ala Tameh. The Tohor will sprinkle on the Tameh. V'zah Torah l'atzmei b'yom ha'shlishi v'yom ha'shvi'i v'tchit'o b'yom ha'shvi'i v'chabeis b'gadav r'chatz b'mayim v'tayer b'erev. So now, the v'chit'o b'yom ha'shvi'i, which is the sprinkling that is done b'yom ha'shvi'i, that's the completion of the Tara process. So that v'chit'o, what is that being connected to? Is that being connected to the first half of the Pasuk, or is that being connected to the second half of the Pasuk? So the way Rabbi reads it is that the v'chit'o is referencing to the earlier part of the Pasuk, and therefore Rabbi says over here, Rabbi Savar Viza Tohor, Ala Tamei B'yom HaShlishi U'Vayom HaShi'i V'chit'o, and that will make him Tohor. Rabbanan Savei, V'chit'o B'yom HaShvi'i V'chabeis B'gadav R'chatz B'mayim, that to complete the Tara on the seventh day, he has to launder his clothing and V'chatz B'mayim and put his body into the mikveh. So over here, which way does the chit'o go? The truth is the etnachta is following the sheet of the chachamim, which is that the pasuk breaks like this. V'zah Torah l'atzmei b'yom ha'shlishi v'yom ha'shvi'i. Pause. That's the etnachta. V'chit'o b'yom ha'shvi'i b'chabeis b'gadav r'chatz b'mayim v'taher b'ayrev. So what the chachamim say is v'chit'o b'yom ha'shvi'i is connected to the going to the mikveh. It says r'chatz b'mayim. So the completion of the tara or the sprinkling, the hazayah, is connected with the tvilah. And therefore, that will govern. The rules of tefillah will govern here by the hazayah. On the other hand, Rabbi parses the pasuk the other way, which is, v'zah Torah al-tamei b'yom ha'shlishi v'yom ha'shvi'i v'chit'o. And then, that will be the tahara, or the process by which he becomes tahor. Then, v'yom ha'shvi'i v'chibeis b'gadav v'chatz b'mayim v'tayer b'erev. The v'chit'o is referencing or going to the first part of the pasuk. So the v'chit'o, the tahara, is associated with the first half of the pasuk, which is Vizor Tara or Ala Tamei. And there the Tamei is mentioned in particular, or the Tum'ah is mentioned in particular. And so for that reason, Tum'ah is the governing principle over here. Rabbanan Nami Nidmei the Tum'ah. So why don't the Rabbanan follow Rabbi's precedent and say, let's connect it to the Tum'ah? Tara, Mimitara, Havalei the Melef. Makes more sense to learn out the process of Tara from a process of Tara. Hazayah and Tvilah are more akin than Hazayah and Tumah. Rabbi Nidme the Tvilah says, if you want to do that, why don't you compare it to Tvilah? He says, because V'chibes Bigadav Hivsika Inyan. Even according to the Chachamim, in the Pasuk it says, V'chit'o B'yom HaShvi'i V'chibes Bigadav, then V'chatz B'mayim V'taher Ba'arev. So that the V'chatz B'mayim is not directly juxtaposed to the V'chit'o B'yom HaShvi'i. Then clean your clothes, then go to the mikveh. So mikveh is not directly juxtaposed to v'chito b'yom ha'shvi'i, and therefore chibes b'gadav is in between, therefore chito makes more sense to connect it to that which is before. Is that really true that Rabbi believes that the tongue is considered to be tamun for tvilah, meaning that it does not require to go into the mikveh? There was an incident with a maidservant in the house of Rabbi. We know that we have numerous of these items in Shas, where the shfachot, the maidservants of Rabbi's household, either come up in halachic discussions, there were instructions given by Rabbi to them, or that they're asking questions of the chachamim. Shetavla va'alta, she went into the mikveh, came out, v'nimtza etzem ben shina, and they found a bone between her teeth. V'tzricha Rabbi tvila cheret. Rabbi required that she go into the mikveh again, to go in because it did not qualify. So now the Gemara gives the answer to that question. It's true that as far as going into the mikveh, your mouth, the inside parts that are not made right, do not need to come into contact with the water. Nevertheless, we still need a place that can, the water could have come, that there would be no hefsek, there would be no chatzitza if you did go into the water. So even though the mouth itself does not need to come into contact with the water, your mouth has to be clean to the point that if water did come in there, it would have worked and there would be no chatzitza. So obviously the question is, listen, if it has to go into the mikveh, it should go into the mikveh. If it doesn't have to go into the mikveh, why does it need the qualifications of no chatzitza, of not going into the mikveh? So, but good to Rabbi Zeira, like Rabbi Zeira, Dam Rabbi Zeira, kol haroi lebila, ein bila me'akevet bo. Shein ro'i l'bila, bila me'akevet bo. So this is the famous principle of Rabbi Zeira with regards to minachot. When it comes to minachot, there is a cap as to the largest size mincha that you can bring, and that is shishim isaron. If a person says that he wants to bring a super big mincha, and he wants to bring a 61 Yisaron mincha, 62 Yisaron mincha, we do not allow him to do that. We say that you're capped out at 60, and then you have to bring it in two kelim. You have to bring it as two separate minachot. The reason being is because when it comes to the blila, the mixing of the mincha, you have to mix the mincha properly and well. There are different ingredients. There's the flour, there's the oil, there are items that have to be mixed together, the water that's there, all of that has to be mixed together in the mincha. What the Chachamim established is that up to 60 Yisaron is possible to mix properly and to get a good mixture. So that's what's called Blilat HaMincha. Rabbi Zeira's principle says, Kol HaRo'uy LeBila. Anything that possibly could be mixed, in Bila Ma'akevet Bo. Bila, the mixing is not a problem. So over here, even if you bring a Mincha that is 60 Yisaron big, and you don't mix it, it's still a good Mincha. Wait a minute, you have to mix it, it has to be blila. That's not the problem. As long as you could mix it, that is sufficient grounds to be considered as if it's mixed, and you can bring it. On the other hand, if you bring a mincha that's too big, that can't be mixed. Even if you did mix it, it wouldn't mix, then blila me'akevet bo. So even though blila in general is not me'akev by a korban mincha, that's only true if it was possible to do the blila, if it's possible to do the mixing. If it's not possible to do the mixing, then the blila will be a problem. It will be an issue. Now, Tosafot raises issues here with a number of these items. The first of which is, in the Torah, the word blila appears numerous times with regards to the mincha. And we have a principle by Kodoshim that whenever a tzivoy or a command is mentioned once, it means that it's the mitzvah, the chatchila. When it's mentioned a second time, it's the akev. That means that it's me'akev, and even b'diavad, you would need blila. The fact that the word blila is mentioned innumerable amounts of times by the minachot means that it's definitely mentioned twice. So why is it not me'akev? What we're saying here is blila is not me'akev. It's only a mitzvah l'chatchila. As long as you can do it, that's good enough. You don't even have to do it. It's only a mitzvah l'chatchila, b'diavad. Even if you don't mix it, it's fine. Why not? Why isn't it problematic, b'diavad? So Tosafot says here and other places in Shas where this comes up, he knows that the word blila that is used is not the active verb ubalal, that you must mix it. It's telling you the status or the state of the mincha, which is blubla b'shemen. It is mixed in oil. And therefore, the reading of the word blula versus ubalal tells you that it's not a tzivoy, a command. And therefore, you would say, since it's mentioned twice, the first one's l'chatchila, the second one's ma'akev, but rather, it's just telling you the state of the mincha. And the state of the mincha is that blula. So the chatchila, that is the state of the mincha. But we're not demanding or commanding you to do the blila, and therefore that's why it's not me'akev b'di'avad. That's number one. Number two is, the parallel between mincha and tvila are not so clear. And that is because by the mincha, you have a mitzvah, the chatchila, livlo. You have a mitzvah l'chatchila to mix the mincha. Therefore, the principle of Rabbi Zeira says that since you have a mitzvah l'chatchila to mix it, then it has to be possible to mix it. Otherwise, it fails. And if it's not possible to mix it, then you can't use it. And even in a case where it is possible to mix it, if you don't mix it, it's okay because you could mix it. So from there, we're trying to extrapolate to tevila and say the same thing. That by the mouth of the individual, even though the waters don't have to enter the mouth of the individual, nevertheless, there has to be a place that is ra'oi for the waters to go in. But why? What mitzvah the chatchila do you have for the waters to go into the mouth of the individual? By the mincha, there's a mitzvah the chatchila to mix it. And therefore, you could say there's a demand that it be mixable. But in the case of tvila, where is there a mitzvah the chatchila to get water into your mouth? There's no mitzvah the chatchila to open up your mouth and your eyes when you're in the mikveh, because there's no mitzvah l'chatchila. If that's the case, why would you say that it has to be a makom that's ra'oi l'tvila? There's no reason to believe that it needs to be tvila or any connection to tvila whatsoever. It's no requirement. So Tosfot asks, how do you parallel the case of mincha to tvila? Tosfot in the end says that the pasuk by tvila also says v'chatz et kol b'saro v'mayim. The word kol comes to be an inclusive term. And therefore, not only is it v'chatz b'saro b'mayim, where it's just the flesh, but kol b'saro. And the word kol there is inclusive to say l'chatchila, you really need to get all these places in. And therefore, there is an aspect of l'chatchila that is also associated with the tefillah because of kol b'saro, and therefore lechatchila, or we would prefer, if you could, to get everything in. Now, we don't require you to open up your mouth, and we don't require you to open your eyes, but since it says kol b'saro, it has to be that all those areas that the water could possibly touch have to be ra'ui l'tevilah. And so that's how Tosfot creates a parallel between the case of tevilah and mincha. Now, coming to tevilah, the question that you have to ask by tevilah is with regards to the tongue, for instance. By regards to the tongue, if you consider the tongue to be an area that's exposed, Rabbi already agreed that when you do tevilah, the tongue only has certain aspects of the tongue that are considered to be bigaloi. That's the tongue or the part of the tongue that wags or can be extended outward. The part that's attached to the mouth is not considered to be galoi. So why don't we simply demand, you're right, your whole tongue doesn't need to go into the mikveh, but at least the wagging part of the tongue should go to the mikveh. So Rashi clarifies that and says, first of all, you can't take your whole tongue out of your mouth and put it in the mikveh. That's not possible. If you're going to tell me just put out the part of the tongue or the part of the tongue that needs to be go in, we don't have such a thing as tefilo the mikzat. That only a portion of you or a piece of you has to go into the mikveh. Aval negia koshu avya negia. But with regards to contact for tuma, negia, touching, we don't require that you touch the whole person. By definition, touch is only a partial touch. Through that, Rashi explains the difference between tuma and tvila. Why by tuma do we say that the standard is any negia? And therefore, Rabbi believes by the case of tuma that that's considered to be contact when you touch a portion of the tongue. And by mikveh, it's not that way, or tzvila is not that way. And the answer has to do with the nature of contact. By tumah, negiyah is the demand, which means any touch, any little contact. Doesn't need to be full contact. Therefore, the tongue, not the whole tongue, but any portion of the tongue that is visible will be sufficient to generate the negiyah or the giloy that you need for negiyah. And by mikveh, it's just the opposite. Mikveh requires bisaro, or kol bisaro. It means require the whole limb or the whole part of the individual to be there. So therefore, you can't just say, oh, a portion of the tongue needs to go into the mikveh, stick it out. That doesn't work, because a tongue or mikveh requires the entirety of the individual or the entirety of the tahara process to happen, not just a portion of tahara. So that explains the difference. Now, with regards to the chatzitzot, we are choshesh for this din here, that when it comes to going to the mikveh, or when a woman goes to the mikveh, or a man goes to the mikveh, we not only make sure that the chatzitzot are on the visible part of the body, but even the parts of the body that are not visible and not required to go in the mikveh, we make sure that they don't have any chatzitzot. So that's why you're not supposed to eat meat before one goes to the mikveh, because pieces get stuck in the mouth, or you have to floss your teeth beforehand to make sure there's nothing stuck between them, or in the eyes, that there's no mucus or gunk that's there. That would be considered a chatzitza, even though, again, there's no requirement that the water go in there. And therefore, we are choshesh for this shita. There is a machloket amongst the Rishonim of whether this chashash is a din d'oraita. And the application here of the makumot astarim, those hidden places, whether that's a requirement d'oraita, that they have no chatzitzot, because like Tosfot says, from et kol b'saro b'mayim, or whether this is really just an imposition d'rabbanon. The Rabbanan made this a stringency because if we don't demand that they clear out all the chatzitzot here, it's going to lead to places where they won't worry about chatzitzot in other places. So we want to get rid of all chatzitzot. But this is simply an enhancement mid the Rabbanan, not necessarily a din d'oraita. Obviously, that'll have ramifications in cases of safek as to whether the person would have to go back into the mikveh or not, depending on whether it was a din d'rabbanan or a din d'oraita. All right, so now the Gemara continues. Now that we've already established that Rabbi believes that Lashon has different statuses in different areas of Halacha, with regards to Tuma, he agrees that it is considered to be Galoi, or a Bar Negi'ah. By the case of Eved Ivri, he considers it to be Galoi, and by the case of Mikveh, he considers it to be Tamun. So that's Rabbi Shita. The Chachamim disagree and say that the tongue by the Eved is not considered to be Galoi, that's the Tanakhama's position. And by Tvila, obviously they agree that it's not Galoi. And by the case of Tum'ah, they would agree that it can have Negiyah. The one area they have left over is Hazayah. And that's where Rabbi and the Chachamim disagreed again, which is that by Hazayah, Rabbi said it's compared to Tum'ah, and therefore any contact is enough, and the tongue is considered to be Galoi. Whereas the Chachamim compared it to Tvila, and therefore Hazayah does not have a din of the tongue being exposed. So now we dealt with that. Now the Gemara goes back to the question of Sirus. What is the din of Sirus? The Gemara says, Kitanae. It is a machloket tanaim as to whether Sirus is considered to be galoi. Now, the Gemara already addressed that. We already brought the Braita that has the machloket between Rabbi and the Tanakama as to whether it's galoi or not. What we have here is an enhanced explanation of it because there's a third Tana over here. And the third Tana bifurcates the din between Chachamim and Rabbi. And therefore now that's an additional opinion which enhances our understanding of this machloket as to whether it's considered to be exposed or not, which is in the mumim that are mentioned by the animals in Emor, in Vayikra Chavet, when you bring animals to the Migdash, kol asher bo mum lo takrivu, anything that has a blemish in it, you cannot put on the Mizbeach. Kilo l'ratzoni yelechem, that's not a ratzon. And then it gives you a list of problematic animals. And there later on in the pasuk it says, umauch v'chatzut v'natuk, Vikarut lo takrivu l'Hashem. Baratzachem lo tasu. None of these items can be put on the Mizbeach, as well as the fact that you're not allowed to make this in your land. That goes to the restriction that you're not allowed to castrate animals. But all of these items, ma'uch, katuv, natuk, vikarut, are types of castration, or that impede the reproductive capabilities of the individual. So here, the Braita says, umauch, which means like squeeze, katut means crush, natuk means torn, karut means cut, kulan bibetzim divrei Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says, the description here of the mumim are all referring to the testicles. Beitzim velo begit, it refers only to the testicles and not to the member itself. Elo kulan af bibetzim divrei Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says that all of these mumim apply not only to the member itself, but also to the testicles. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov Omer, kulam begid. Blaz ben Yaakov is the exact opposite opinion, which is, these only apply to the member, and they do not apply to the beitzim. So these would equate to the positions of the Tanakama before and Rabbi. Tanakama before said that beitzim, testicles, have no din of galoi at all. The only thing that's galoi is the member. So therefore, the ma'uk, katut, natuk, bekarut be referring to the member, and that would be similar to this position of Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. Rabbi believed that by the beitzim, that it was considered to be galoi. And that would be akin, seemingly, to the position of Rabbi Yehuda. And now we have this in-between, or compromise position, which is Rabbi Yossi Omer, ma'uch bikatut af beitzim, that by the case of squeezed and crushed, that's applicable even by the testicles. Natuk bikarut begid in bebeitzim lo. On the other hand, when it comes to natuk bikarut, that is applicable to the member, not applicable to the testicles. The difference being the visibility from the outside. Again, if the testicles are severed or cut, that means that they're still there intact. They've been severed from their ability to be used or productive because they now can't pass into the physiological systems of the body. So in terms of visibility, the person looks exactly the same if he was healthy. On the other hand, by the case of ma'uch v'katot, where there's a change in the physical status of the testicles, they've been crushed, they've been squeezed, there it's visible from the outside because you can see in the scrotum that they're no longer there. There's no longer the testicles that are there. Therefore, it's a visible mum. And so he differentiates between, in these four mumim, he differentiates between the two factors. Rashi notes over here that ma'uch v'katut are minkar tzvei. They are much more visible or obvious because Mu'uch means, as Rashi says in Chumash, Beitzav mu'uchim biyad, they were crushed by the hand. And katut means k'tushim heim yoter mi ma'uch. They're even more crushed or squeezed down than the ma'uch. That's why I translated ma'uch as squeezed and katut as crushed because it's something more severe. V'natuk is a lashon of severing. That was done by the hand. They were severed, the beitzim. And last one is karut, which means that they were severed through a kli and not by hand. So as Rashi notes over here, karut is krutim achutim shebeitzim tluim behen. The strings or the attachment for the testicles back into the bodily systems, they were severed, they were cut. Umorim b'miksat v'enim nuktuvim legamrei. They're still somewhat attached, they're still somewhat existent there, not completely detached. Natuk is b'yad legamrei. The tuk is done by hand and is completely severed. V'dayin tlulim bekis. But they're still there in this scrotum. And natuk havei tzfei mi karut. Natuk is a more extreme form of karut. And that means that if someone is notake after karut, then they are chayav, or that's considered to be more damage being done. Just like the same way that katut is a more extreme form of ma'uch. And so therefore, the difference he makes is the nature of the mum tells you whether it's going to be visible from the outside or not. And that's what Rabbi Yossi's compromised position is. Now, it's seemingly Rabbi's position is akin to Rabbi Yehuda, although you could argue that Rabbi's position is really Rabbi Yossi's position, which is that sirus, in this case, when he's referring to sirus, it has to be something that the sirus is noticeable from the outside. And therefore, Rabbi Yossi gives you what is noticeable from the outside and what is not noticeable from the outside, and maybe Rabbi would agree in that case. But anyhow, that's the Gemara's answer to the question. It is a machloket tanaim as to whether sirus in this manner would be considered visible so that it would free the slave. According to Rabbi Yehuda, yes, any damage to the testicles, to the scrotum, would be a reason or grounds for him being freed. Rabbi Yaakov says it'll never be grounds. And Rabbi Yossi has that compromised position that it depends on the nature of the damage, whether it's visible from the outside or not visible from the outside. All right, now we move on to the next Mishnah. The next two Mishnayot are extremely fundamental Mishnayot. Yeshivot spend many weeks and weeks on these Mishnayot because these are the fundamentals of Kinyanim. And over here we're starting with the Kinyanim of Mitaltalim. And tomorrow we'll deal with the Mishnah that deals with Kinyanim for Karka or for real property. So here the Mishnah begins. Behema gasa niknet b'misira. Large animals are acquired through misira. Vadaka b'hagba. And lighter animals, or the smaller animals, through hagba, through lifting up. Divrei Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Lezer. That's the position of Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Lezer. Chamim armim, behema daka niknet b'mishicha. Behema daka can be acquired through mishicha. What you have over here are three different methods of kinyan. Now, the purpose of a kinyan is twofold. One is to have gemirat hadat, which is that when we talk about something, we're talking about a transaction, we want to have finality to that. Finality in the sense that there's something or an action that shows that we've come to an agreement, and this is the final stage, and done is done. So that's what gemirat hadat involves. The second thing we need is an exertion of ownership by the purchasing party, which is we want him to demonstrate or do some demonstrable act that shows that he is the owner of this item. Our Mishnah mentions three different vehicles for that. There's Hagba'ah. Now, according to everyone, Hagba'ah is the best way to accomplish a kinyan because it's very straightforward. You're lifting up the object and taking it, bringing it into your possession. That is pretty straightforward that should work. And that is the strongest form of kinyan that one can do, because the picking it up and raising it takes it away from whatever location it's in and brings it into your possession. But the other two vehicles here are misira and mishicha. And in this instance, there is a machloket about how they function and which one is better. So we'll start with mishicha. Mishicha means to pull the animal, to make it move from one location to another location. That can be done either by pulling on the reins and making it move, or from hitting it from behind and making it move, or using your voice to force it to move. In all those cases, there's what's called a kinyan mishicha, is you move the animal. The third kinyan is a misira. Kinyan misira is where something is handed over to you by another party. So for instance, the classic example of misira would be where the current owner of the animal hands the reins to the buyer of the animal. That would be a kinyan misira. Over here, there's a machloket between Rashi and the Balei HaTosafot as to what misira is in this case. Rashi says misira has to be literally that the seller hands over the reins to the buyer. It's not enough that he tells him, take the reins. He has to physically hand them over. Rashi says miyad the yad. It has to go from hand to hand, and that is the form of misira that is required. The Rivam agrees with Rashi that is the vehicle of misira. On the other hand, Tosafot brings Vakasha the Ri. The Ri asks on this, and therefore he's Lachein the Ri Nira the Rabbi, Tlo Beina Miyad Biyad. Tosafot says, I don't think you need direct passing of the item from the hand of the seller to the hand of the buyer. Halakim Damar Lech Chazek V'Kanei Kana. Just has to be the seller gives you permission to do it. If the seller says, go take the reins, he doesn't have to physically hand you the reins. The fact that he gave you permission to take the reins and you take the reins, that is a kinyan misira. So those are the three forms of kinyanim that you have. Again, in terms of hierarchy, it's clear that kinyan agbah is the strongest form of kinyan. When it comes to mishicha and misira, here we have a major machloket between Rashi, the Rabbeinu Tam on one side, and the Ri and the Rashbam on the other side. Rashi believes that misira, you can see this in the Mishnah, when you say that, Abeima Gasa is nicknamed be misira, Rashi says, Aval mishicha lo mikanyo. Mishicha doesn't work. Dein darka b'kach lo licha lefanav. Because that's not the normal way. You don't drive a big animal in front of you. You don't push it in front of you. And therefore, misira is the proper form of kinyan, not mishicha. Tosafot concludes from that Rashi believes that misira is a higher form of kinyan. Why? Because it makes sense, or logically, if you use a higher form of kinyan, it should work, and the ability to use a lower form of kinyan is a dispensation. So that means that if I use hagba'ah in all of these cases, it should work because it's the best form of kinyan. Okay, by behema gasa, it's a little hard to lift the animal up. So therefore, what do? We give you a dispensation to use misira. Well, Rashi says, well, if I gave you a dispensation to use misira, that means misira, yes, but not mishicha, because mishicha is even a lower form of kinyan. How do I know that? Because mishicha is used by the behema daka, by the lighter animals. We use a kinyan mishicha. So for Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam, the hierarchy works this way. Hagba'ah is the best form of kinyan. The next level of kinyan is misira. And then the lowest form of kinyan is mishicha. That means for an animal that you do mishicha with, you could do mishicha, misira, or hagba'ah. For an animal that you can do misira for, behema gasa, you can do misira or hagba'ah. For an item that requires hagba'ah, that's the only way that you can do it. Because that's the hierarchy of the forms of kinyanim. On the other hand, the Ri and the Rashbam believe that mishicha is a better form of kinyan. Misira is a dispensation because big animals are hard to move. You can't move the big animals. You can't drive them. So they made it easier by making it into a kinyan misira. Misira is the lowest form of kinyan because over there you don't have to do anything. You're not moving the animal. You're not lifting the animal. You're simply handing over the reins of the animal. And according to the way the Bali Yitzel Sefo learned, it's just simply telling him to take the reins and he takes the reins. That's enough. So that would be the lowest form of kinyan. Mishicha, which involves you're not lifting the animal, but you are moving it from the property of the mocher into a different location where you can acquire it. And therefore, that is a better form of kinyan than misira. And then the best form of a kinyan is the kinyan hagba'ah. And that means that the way that they read the Mishnah, when it says over here, by a behema gasa, you can use misira, that's a dispensation to use the lowest form of kinyan. But if you did a kinyan mishicha, it would work according to the Ri and the Rashbam. Unlike what Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam say, where it's misira exclusively and not mishicha, because they see misira as being better than mishicha. On the other hand, the Ri and the Rashbam view mishicha as a better kinyan. So you can do misira. You want to do mishicha? Kol hakavod? Do mishicha. That's even a better kinyan. You want to do agba? Go ahead. You can do that. It's even a better kinyan. But as a fundamental machloka between Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam on one side, who say that misira is a higher form of kinyan than mishicha, versus the Ri and the Rashbam on the other side, and truthfully, most of the Rishonim are on that other side, which is that the hierarchy is hagba'ah, then mishicha, then misira. Misira is the lowest form of kinyan that you can have. Obviously, with implications, if you're granted the right to do misira, what does mishicha do for you? Now, the Pnei Yeshua over here explains the machloket between them as having to do with the nature of how they view the types of kinyanim over here. The Ri and the Rashbam say that the focus is on the reasonability or the functionality of the kinyan, which is that buying items that you can pick up, obviously picking them up is the best way to form a kinyan. Buy other items where you can do a kinyan mishicha, that a mishicha is the next form of kinyan that you can do. Buy misira, which is the weakest form of kinyan because you can't move the animal. The animal is just too big to move. So therefore, for them, the hierarchy is kagba on top, then mishicha, then misira. And the dispensation has to do with the ability to move this animal or this object. The more movable the object is, the more we're going to ask you to do in terms of a kinyan. We're going to make you do a kinyan agba. The less you can move it, then go to Kenya Meshicha. If you can't move it at all, then we go to Kenya and Misira. So the hierarchy would be Hagba, Meshicha, Misira. On the other hand, Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam see the nature of visibility of the Kinyan as being the primary aspect over here. So Kinyan Agba, again, is the most visible or obvious type of Kinyan, and that's why it's the top Kinyan. Between Mishicha and Misira, he says that Misira is a more obvious exchange of ownership. Because by Mishicha, you could be chasing someone's animal out of your yard. You could be doing something that doesn't make it obvious that there's a change in ownership. Misira is a direct, especially according to Rashi, a direct handing of the reins from the seller to the buyer, which makes it clear that there was an exchange of ownership rather than simply the chasing of an animal or the moving of an animal. And therefore, Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam see the hierarchy as being Hagba'ah, then Misira, and then Mishicha at the bottom of the list. All right, so because of that, a Kinyan Hagba'ah, based on this, works anywhere. Kinyan Agbah can work, whether you're in the property of the seller, the property of the buyer, the public domain, private domain, does not matter. Kinyan Agbah is such a strong form of Kinyan, it works anywhere, because you're bringing it into your possession by lifting it. Mishicha only works Birishuto or Rishuto Shel Shnehem. It only works if you bring it into the possession or into the property of the buyer or a property that's jointly owned by the buyer and the seller. Because the nature of the Kinyan Mishicha is that I'm taking the animal, I'm moving it, but I gotta move it basically into my Rishut. And therefore I gotta move it into a location that has relevance to me. Misira can only be done by Rishut She'enu Shel Shnehem or Rishut HaRabim. It can only be done in a place that belongs to neither party or in the public domain, which obviously does not belong to either party. Because the nature of the Misira is that I'm giving the ownership over through the passing of the reins, but that cannot be impeded by the fact that it's in my property or your property. And so Misira works that way, where it's in the Rishut HaRabim or Rishut She'enu Shel Shnehem. And so according to Rashi, again in the Mishnah, when you say that it uses Misira, he means Misira exclusively and not Mishicha. For the Balei HaTosafot, meaning for the Ri and the Rashbam, that means that if you want to use Misira, you can. If you want to, you can also use Mishicha. Now, based on that, isn't subsumed in every Mishicha and Misira in some sense? Isn't that because when you give over the Mishicha and you're pulling it, there's also a Misira involved? If that's the case, why are there limitations as to the location of the Mishicha, which we said has to be into his property or into a property that's jointly owned, versus Misira, which could be done even in Rishut HaRabim? So why can't you do Mishicha in Rishut HaRabim and say it's just a Misira and it should work as a Misira? The answer the Ran gives to that is that once you've determined the vehicle of acquisition that you use, it's as if you're saying, I want this vehicle and not that vehicle. So if you use a Kinyan Mishicha, it's saying, I'm using Mishicha and not Misira. Therefore, if you do Mishicha and Rishut HaRabim, it won't work because you didn't do a Misira. Had you done a Misira, it would have worked. But you didn't choose that vehicle. You used a different vehicle. And therefore, each vehicle stands independently and does not overlap one with the other. And if you use one, it means that you're doing that and not the other. That's an important distinction. So even though we allow for you to use different types of kinyanim over here, depending on the level of kinyan, still doesn't mean if you do one, that it means that you're doing both of them together. No, you're picking one vehicle of kinyan, and that vehicle of kinyan, you have to qualify for all the trappings of that kinyan. Dorosh Rav b'Kimchonaya. So Rav was Doresh in a place called Kimchonaya. Be'emagasa niknate b'mishicha. That be'emagasa can be acquired through mishicha. Ashkachinu Shmuel l'tamidei d'Rav. Shmuel found the students of Rav. Amalahu. Mi amar Rav be'im agasa niknet b'mishicha. Did Rav really say that a be'im agasa could be acquired through mishicha? Va'anan b'misiratnan. Then we learn that our mission says it's a misira. Rav nami misira amar. Rav also said misira. Because the mission says misira. And Rav himself used to say misira works. Then the way Rashi reads this, hadar be mehahi. This is the statement of Shmuel. Meaning Shmuel says, did he really change his mind? And that's the end of Shmuel's statement, which is he's asking a question of the Talmidim of Rav. Did he back out of that position? Meaning that did he not say Misira? According to Rashi, the way Rashi reads that means, did he not say Misira anymore? Did he back out of that position and say that Misira is not the only thing, that Mishicha is also good? And the end of the Talmidim of Rav is, Huda Marka Aitana, yes, Eino Chanami. Mishicha works both for Bei Magasa and Bei Madaka. And according to Rashi, I mean, Koshke and Masira would work by Bei Magasa, but Mishicha works. And that's the way that the conversation went. Hudamar, ki ay Tana. Then Tamidim answered that he holds like this Tana. The Tanya, we have a Braita. Mechumim Amim, Zo Vizo Niknek Mishicha. Both of them, Bei Magasa and Bei Madaka, are acquired through Mishicha. Vishim and Omer, Zo Vizo Bagba'ah. They're both done through Hagba'ah. So you see here, there is a Tana who has an opinion that Mishicha works both by Behem Agasa and by a Behem Daka. That it works by both of them. And that's who Rav was following. Now, our Mishnah agrees that a Behem Daka can be done through Mishicha. But over here, he's saying that Behem Agasa can also be done by Mishicha. And that's the way Rashi would explain the Gemara here, which is, when the Shmuel asked the Talmidim of Rav, why did Rav allow Mishicha? Doesn't our Mishnah say Misira? And the way Rashi is reading that, that means Misira only and not Mishicha. And so, if he allowed Mishicha, then he certainly would have allowed Misira, because Mishicha is a lower form of Kinyan, according to Rashi. And therefore, if he allowed Mishicha, he certainly would allow Misira. And Shmuel says, but our Mishnah says Misira only and not Mishicha, because Misira is a higher form of Kinyan. If you can wire Misira, then you can't have Mishicha. And that's the nature of the back and forth according to Rashi. And that's what Shmuel is asking. Hodor Hebei Mehahi. Did Rav relent on that position? Did he change his mind with regards to Misira? And the Gemara says that he holds like this other Tana. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot read the Hodor Hebei Mehahi as being the answer of the Talmidim of Rav, rather than the question of Shmuel. Which is, Shmuel says, wait a minute, did Rav really say that it's Nikdei B'Mishicha? Don't we have a Mishnah that says that Misira? And Rav also mentions Misira. The Talmidim answers Shmuel, Hodor Bei Mehahi. He relented on that position. He backed out of the position saying that Misira was good. And rather, he said Mishicha. And this is Tosafot the Shitato, who says that Mishicha is a better form of Kinyan than Misira. And therefore, if Rav says Mishicha, it means exclusively Mishicha and not Misira. And that's what it means. Hadar Bei Hamehoi, Rav relented on that position of Misira, and he holds only Mishicha is good, Misira is no good at all. That Rav was Chuzer Bei Misira because of the Braita that we're about to bring, and that caused him to change his mind about Misira and to say no, that the vehicle of acquisition here is Mishicha, and not Misira. And therefore, since Mishicha is a higher form of Kinyan, according to the Balei Tosafot, that means Mishicha exclusively and not Misira. And that was the nature of Shmuel's question. If Rav is saying Mishicha, that means Mishicha exclusively and not Misira. But our Mishnah says Misira, and I heard Rav say Misira. If he says Misira, obviously Mishicha would also be good, but it means that he allows for Misira. And the Talmidim of Rav say no. Hadar Mehahi. He relented on that position. He backed out of the position about Misira. And he says exclusively Mishicha is the only vehicle for acquisition over here. Ben Behem Agasa, Ben Behem Adaka, based on the Lashona Bright that we brought. Now the Gemara says, Matkiv la Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef now asks, Elmiata, Peel the Rabbi Shimon, but Mame Yikne. If you want to acquire an elephant, according to Rabbi Shimon, how are you going to do this? So now, first of all, it's an interesting question from Yosef. First of all, Rabbi Shimon's not the halacha. So even though we bring Rabbi Shimon's opinion down that Agba is the only vehicle for Kinyan, it's not the halacha. So why is Rabbi Yosef querying within the position of Rabbi Shimon? There are two reasons for that. One is he might be trying to prove that the Braita that we just brought is not a good Braita. If we can show that Rabbi Shimon's opinion makes no sense, then so too, maybe Rabbi Shimon is misquoted in the Braita, and then there's no support for Rav's position. That's one reason why Rabbi Yosef might be questioning it. The other possibility is, as we mentioned before, that Hagbah is a super Kinyan. And therefore, Hagbah is applicable to all opinions. So you may not have to do it that way, but since it's an option, how do you do it? Use a Kinyan Chalipim, inami b'socheret mekomo. Or you rent the location and it becomes a Kinyan Agav. So now, these two answers are ways to do kinyanim, let's say, on a larger number of items. Before we're speaking in our Mishnah, doing Mishicha, doing Misira, or doing Alba, that works well when you're dealing with a small, defined amount of objects, or a limited number of animals, then it makes sense to use these kinyanim. But if you're dealing with like a flock of animals where you want to acquire them, then there are better vehicles for that. And that's what Abaye is saying over here. You can use a kinyan chalipin, which is a way to do a figurative exchange, or you can do sukhert makamo, which is a kinyan agav, that you rent the location. By renting the location, you now own the location. And agav, that you own the location, you also take acquisition of all the metaltalim that are on the position. Again, the Gemara will get to this after the next Mishnah about what's called a kinyan agav. But here are two different or new vehicles for kinyanim. One's a kinyan karka that involves the ability through that kinyan karka to also acquire the metaltalim that are on the karka. And a kinyan chalipin here, which we saw earlier in the Masechta, functions as or in place of kinyan kesef. But it is a form of kinyan that's independent of hagba'ah, mishlicha, or misira. It's its own form of kinyan that would suffice or be just as good as hagba'ah. Rabbi Zeir Amar, Rabbi Zeir comes up with an interesting solution. Mevi arba'ah kelim. You bring four kelim. Umenicham tachat raglav. It's like in the circus. Bring four of your kelim, and you have the elephant step up onto the kelim. So therefore, you can acquire him now because he's standing on your kelim. Shmamina, from this you can conclude, Kelav shelokeach b'shut mocher, the elephant's in the owner's location. Now the lokeach brings his kelim here, puts them down, and says, step up onto them. Kana lokeach. And again, we've investigated this numerous times, and the question of whether the kelim of the lokeach can work in the reshut mocher. When they're in the area that's owned by the mocher, do his kelim have sufficient independent significance in the area of the mocher to give him an acquisition? So Gemara says, no. Halchav ma'iskinan. Here's the case that we're dealing with. Tosafot points out over here that they could have answered something else. First of all, he says, how do you know that's in the Mishuta Mocher? He says, Stam de Milta Mishuta Mocher Mairi. Generally, when you're selling an animal, we're in the possession or the area of the Mocher. And he says, you could have answered. It's in a case where the Mocher says, your Kelim should work over here. When he gives permission, everybody agrees it works. He says that could have been an answer, and that could have been a solution. But the Gemara goes a different direction because it wants to learn something from this, which is Hagamaiskina Bisimto. We're dealing with a side location within the Rishut HaRabim. Zavit Shi Yetzel Rishut HaRabim. It is a corner, whether it's a dead end or it's an offshoot of the Rishut HaRabim, an area that is not really a public thoroughfare. Veino Lo Rishut HaRabim Lo Rishut HaYachid. It has this twilight status where it sits somewhere between the Rishut HaRabim and the Rishut HaYachid. It's not Rishut HaYachid because it's not owned by any particular individual. It's not Rishut HaRabim because it's not a thoroughfare. It's not where a lot of people go. In that area, what's called the Simta, or areas, Bishuyot, where you can establish ownership or position over there, it would work, which is that you're able to put your kelim down and then establish possession there and have it go through. That's why Tosafot says, actually, that Mesira does not work in a Simta. We said before that Mesira works in Rishut HaRabim, or an area that does not owned by either of them. The Balei Tosafot say that it does not work in a Simta. Because in a Simta, whoever gets there first basically establishes it as their location. Therefore, if the Mocher is there, he already establishes it as location, and therefore if you pass the reins there, it's as if you're passing it in the location of the Mocher. The Lokeach brings his Kelim there and establishes his presence there first, it becomes his. A Simta is a flexible area that can take on the ownership or the properties of the individual using it at that time, and whoever's there first basically establishes that. And when they move on, the next person comes, they establish ownership there. And for that reason, the Balei Tosafot say that you can't do Mesira in a Simta. Inami is a very interesting answer. Bechavilei Zmurot. He uses bundles of twigs or shoots on which he has the elephant stand. So that's Rashi says over here, because Hagvoyim and Arish Loshet Tfachim, they're more than three Tfachim off the ground. So from this Rashi learned two important things. Rashi believes that a Kinyan Agbah requires three Tfachim, that's to get it out of the world of Lavud. Lovud usually is three tefachim. If you want to demonstrate ownership, you got to move it more than three tefachim to show that you've changed the location, the reshut of the object. Therefore, Rashi says a kinyan agbah requires three tefachim. Number two, he's saying that stam kelim are not three tefachim high. Therefore, the answer here is chavilei zmurot, which are three tefachim high, versus using kelim, which are not three tefachim high, and that's the nature of this second answer, which is the difference between chavilei zmurot and kelim, is that the Chavilei Zmurot have three Tfachim high. The Rabbeinu Tam argues on Rashi and says that a Kinyan Agbah only requires one Tefach and not three Tfachim. He's not coming here to come out of lavud. It's just to demonstrate ownership. And a tefach is enough just to show that you've lifted it, that you've done something to this item. You don't have to take it out of the rishut and bring it into your rishut. Kenyan Gaba is a demonstrable ownership. Demonstrable ownership simply shows that I've now lifted it. That little act of lifting is enough. And one tefach would suffice over here. So now, according to the Rabbeinu Tam, what you have to say is, stam kelim are not one tefach high. And since they're not one tefach high, it would not work according to that, according to this opinion. And therefore, he wants you to use chamiles murot, which are a tefach high, would allow you to be make the kinyan. But then, the Tosfa brings the Rabbeinu Mishulam, who says that when it says chamiles murot over here, it doesn't mean for the animal to step up on the bundles of twigs, like he did by the kelim, but rather, you throw the food. This is the elephant's food. And you throw it up in the air, and the elephant jumps or gets up in the air in order to get it. And that will be your kinyan hagba'ah. The obvious nafkamina over here is, can you create a kinyan hagba'ah without direct contact? Can you create a kinyan hagba'ah through what's called koach? Through your driving. And what you see from here, the Ksota Choshen says this, that according to the Rabbeinu Meshulam, kinyan hagba'ah, you take kocho, is enough. When you throw the food up and the animal jumps, that's considered to be a kinyan hagba'ah for you. Whereas according to the Rabbeinu Tam and others who do not use that as the explanation of the acquisition here of the chaleis merot, either might say it's not practical, or they might be arguing halachically, which is that you have to have direct contact to do a kinyan hagba'ah. Your koach, a derivative of your action, is not enough to generate a kinyan hagba'ah. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Chav Vav Amud Aleph.